for antiwar.com. I'm Scott Horton and Chaos Radio. Why did I keep fucking that up? I got in the wrong habit, the bad habit. Screwing that up, I meant. Whatever. It's Anti-War Radio. Y'all, I think I'm all set here. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott from Los Angeles to Austin, Texas to your ear holes. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm going to start out the show today talking about Antiwar.com. I've been a fan of Antiwar.com ever since, Bianca Oblivion of Chaos Radio said to me, hey, look at this site. It's called Antiwar.com. I said, oh, cool. Wait a minute, was that some left-wing hippie stuff? She said, no, look, click, click, click. And there was an article called Lincoln, the American Lenin by L. Neil Smith, which I guess Justin had linked to it or something. But anyway, so I said, oh, wow, those guys aren't quite the hippies I would have expected. And anyway, hooked on the site. That was back in, I think, 1999 during the war in Kosovo, and I remember hearing a caller on San Antonio conservative talk radio saying, no, didn't you guys see antiwar.com today? They had a headline that debunked the whole stupid thing you just said. And I remember thinking, oh, cool, antiwar.com, huh? And then I didn't have the internet for a while, and then I got it again, and then I was happy, because basically all I wanted to do with my radio show was interview people who write for antiwar.com, and then put it online where people can listen to it. Put it out over Chaos Radio Waves where people can listen to it and save the archives and put them online. And what the hell, if I'm going to be interviewing nothing but antiwar.com people all damn day, then I guess I ought to go ahead and work for them and do all my interviews for antiwar.com. Why not? So that's this show. So if you appreciate this show, whether you know it or not, you're an antiwar.com appreciator. I think most people found this show that way in the first place. But anyway, so as you may know, times are tough. It's a fun drive time. Once every quarter we do it at antiwar.com, we got to raise some money. And apparently, things are going really slow. The Homeland Security Emergency Meter on the front page of antiwar.com today is still very low, below 14 grand. And, well, that sucks. We very well could be in deep, deep trouble here. And, you know, whatever, it ain't like a bunch of antiwar.com money goes to waste. We got, 6 employees, something like that. It's a virtual office, but a very tight ship. And we can't do it without you. So there you go. That's a funny thing about nonprofit things, right? It's we give it away free, but then we want you to pay whatever you think is good. Donation at the door. Whatever you want. So don't be like Homer Simpson. Just take advantage. You know, help out. Where would you guys be without Justin Raimondo to read all the time? I know I'd be bummed out. Very well may be that that's what antiwar.com ends up being again. Just Eric posting links and Justin writing articles and everything else to the side. There was a giant inflationary bubble after all. Maybe that's all free market America could actually afford to pay for. I guess we'll see. But anyway, so, you know, those of you who are the hardcore fans of this show, and there's only a couple of dozen of you at the most probably, and you know who you are, you know, kick down, man. Whatever you can afford. Not more than you can afford. I'm not sitting here, you know, trying to convince old ladies to make their will out to my church. Not what you can't afford, just what you can. If you can. All right, so that's all I got to say about that. Did I mention I got a great show lined up for you today? Dar Jamil's going to be here live on the phone from Fallujah. Or maybe he's back in Baghdad now. I don't know exactly. From America's West Bank, Iraq. I'll be talking with him about what he's seen since going back there and his new article that he's written for TomDispatch.com. There's so much in the news. Obviously, major attack in Kabul and Afghanistan yesterday. Looks like Afghanistan is the whole top section of antiwar.com today. And then, of course, the Israeli elections. Apparently, Zippy Livni and Benjamin Netanyahu are just absolutely neck and neck there. Oh, did I not say how to send donations? That's a good question. Antiwar.com/donate. That's it. Antiwar.com/donate. You can write a check. You can pay with your card, debit or credit. You can email A. Keaton. Angela. A. Keaton at antiwar.com, and she will hook you up, too. Some fundraiser I am. Like, hey, donate to antiwar.com. Just take that money out of your wallet and throw it in the air. We'll get it somehow. Could have been more specific, I guess. Thank you to, I think that's Darren in the chat room. Yeah. So there you go. And you know what? I'm in a really crappy position to sit up here and ask for money. I haven't even done a show in a month and a half or something. I'm only just now getting back into the swing of things. And, here I am hitting you up for the funds. But basically, without them, there is no show. Simple as that. So if you want there to continue to be the show, then yeah, it is what it is, man. All right. So, and there's so much news, man. I don't want to talk about Israel today. Let's talk about, Glenn Greenwald's great work over at salon.com/opinion/Greenwald. About Obama's, not surprising at all, betrayal of his promise in invoking the state secrets privilege to prevent the tortured from getting a remedy in civil court here in the United States. We all know, each and every one of us knows, that the Obama administration, Eric Holder, our new attorney general, that these men, Barack Obama and his attorney general, that they are not going to appoint special prosecutors to go after Bush, Cheney, Powell, Rice, Tenet, Rumsfeld, Haynes, Addington, Gonzalez, Bybee, you, and the tortured team at all. At all. We know that. But geez, can the tortured at least sue? Try to get a little bit of money? Maybe try to get a little bit of disclosure about what happened to them? Well, no. No, they can't. Because George Bush, well, they couldn't. Because George Bush routinely invoked the state secrets privilege, which means that any fact which might prove that he is a felon may not be admitted in open court. Simple as that. It's a state secret. And doesn't matter that there's no law in America that creates such a thing as state secrets. It was invented simply by judges. And the purpose, at least originally, was only to exclude this particular document or that particular document, which are of too high of a classified nature to be seen in court. Now, there are ways of working around this. They can get security clearances for the judges and then, you know, maybe exclude some evidence from the jury, but then the judge gets to see it and, you know, I don't know how it's all very dubiously constitutional, if you ask me anyway. What Bush has done is said, no, a state secret means your court case must be dismissed. No court may hear your case if any of your case has to do with classified material, particularly when it has to do with him ordering people to be tortured, oftentimes to death. The big test was going to be whether Barack Obama, who denounced this from his perch in the Imperial Senate back before becoming the President of the United States, would go along with this or not. And he had his first test in court, and he failed it. And in fact, I highly recommend you go to Glenn Greenwald's blog and watch the little clip there. It's funny. I don't know. I got mixed feelings about these Democrats on MSNBC. On one hand, never mind Olbermann, but at least Rachel Maddow, she's entertaining. She seems like a nice girl. But I get infuriated by the whole economic thing and the pretended belief that anybody who opposes Democrats is just a Republican. And, I hate arguments that are based like that, and she drives me crazy sometimes. But there's a great little skit, and you can watch the embedded MSNBC player there at Glenn Greenwald's blog on Salon.com, where she does a reenactment from the court transcript with her as the judge and the some guy, I forget, playing the part of the federal prosecutor, reading through what happened at this trial the other day, where the judges were flabbergasted at this hearing the other day. The judges were flabbergasted. What do you mean your position's the same? There's a new administration now and all that, so how about that? And he said, no, I checked with them, and they told me that we are continuing on the Bush standard, invoking the state secrets privilege and trying to deny five people in this case the ability to move forward with their civil lawsuits. And so you see there's no such thing as the rule of law. And so you see that the Constitution as a social contract which creates this government and binds its power is a myth. You see the fairy tale we're all taught as children, right around the same time they're teaching us about Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy, that America is ruled by law, not men, that we have no kings, only public servants, that presidents are merely presidents and bound as all their enforcers below them. Same for, you know, all attorneys general and governors across this land. They are bound by the law, just like you are. It is a lie. It is a damned lie. And you see that the promise that Barack Obama brings hope and change and even means to stand up for the things that he claimed in his own words to believe in and stand for is a bunch of crap as well. In fact, America is ruled by men, not law. And in this case, it happens to be this one guy who maybe you think is a little bit more likable than the last guy. But if you remember, that's was the difference between George Bush and Bill Clinton, too. Oh, finally the grown-ups are in charge. Finally we can get, you know, real experts. Okay, well, not Bush, but Dick Cheney and them, they're the adults. Finally we'll have, some real change, because these people that are slightly different and have a different initial after their congressional title or their party identification somehow make a difference. What will it take to get the American people to snap out of this illusion, this whole liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat ridiculous philosophy of, is it a philosophy? This narrative of the state and its loyal dissenters and the way that they switch back and forth, it's intolerable. It's intolerable. And the idea that Barack Obama will have a five-year honeymoon like George Bush had, that he'll be able to get away with bloody murder and not be called on it, is just sickening. I gotta tell you, I'm thankful for Glenn Greenwald. I'm thankful for Chris Floyd. I'm thankful for Counterpunch. Pretty much everybody at Counterpunch. I'm thankful for the good lefties that are going to continue to hold the government to account by their same principles that they had last time, at least in the places where I agree with their principles, such as opposition to aggressive war, kidnapping, torture, and murder. Seems simple enough. You know, the Bill of Rights is the law. How about that? For something that we can all see eye to eye on. And I'm thankful for the good lefties who are keeping their principles right in front where they matter and refusing to sell out. And that's especially goes for Glenn Greenwald, to Chris Floyd, and others like that. All right, so I'm going to play this here song in honor of Barack Obama. And then I'm going to be right back here with Dar Jamail live on the phone from Fallujah. Everybody, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm pleased to introduce Dar Jamail. He's the author of Beyond the Green Zone, and he's live on the telephone right now from Fallujah or Baghdad? Which is it? Welcome back to the show, Dar.
From Baghdad, Scott. I'm talking to you from Baghdad.
From Baghdad. All right, well, good to talk to you again. Glad to hear that so far you're safe and sound. All right, so let's start out. How long have you been back there?
I've been here almost 3 weeks now. I've spent most of the time in Baghdad, although I have been out to Fallujah two different times now, one of which I spent the night out there. But mostly we've been working around Baghdad.
I see. And so let's start out with Baghdad itself and what you've observed. When was the last time you were there? Not since 05 or 06, right?
Yeah, since 2005. It's been a quite long time, 4 years for me. So it's been a very, very interesting experience for me to come back here after 4 years and see what has changed and see with my own eyes all of these claims being made about how things are so much better here. And what I've experienced is that things are very, very different, but I think calling it better is a bit of a stretch. And what I mean by that is, first of all, when we talk about security, it's certainly true to say that violence is way, way, way down. I mean, we've been going around Baghdad fairly free, of course, still being careful, but security here is unbelievable. I mean, when we look at the fact that there's concrete blast walls all over the place, it's hard to go more than a couple of blocks anywhere and not see some sort of concrete and razor wire barricade. There are patrols everywhere. There's still enormous amounts of American patrols. Let's keep in mind there's still 144,000 American soldiers here. There's mercenaries all over the place, and especially Iraqi army and Iraqi police. They are very, very thick in the streets. It's hard to go more than about four or five blocks anywhere and not see some kind of security someplace. But that said, it makes it rather unsettling, because you can imagine living in a place where people are saying, well, yes, there's better security there, but the reality is that it's kind of like living in a police state, in that everything's being watched. There's men with guns everywhere. There's barriers all over the place. And for Iraqis, it's particularly difficult, because so many of the neighborhoods in Baghdad that had fierce resistance, places like Ghazaliya, Amariya, and other places like this, like Al-Dora, they in Adamiya, they are all completely, literally encircled with 15-foot-high concrete blast walls back-to-back with strictly controlled checkpoints. So people living in these areas, one camp would say, yes, they have security, but on the other hand, you could say, really, they're like living in an open-air prison akin to Gaza. It's a very, very intense experience.
Well, and I guess most of the fighting over Baghdad has ceased. The neighborhoods that were going to change hands from, it's defined by religious sect, but I guess the divisions are more complicated than that. But for the most part, the Sunnis have been basically driven out of Baghdad, and so the war for those neighborhoods is over. That took place in 06, 07.
Well, that's true. Most of the Sunnis have fled, the majority of the people displaced in Baghdad. And let's keep in mind, out of 6 million people who lived here at one time, 1 million of the displaced are Sunni. So their population percentage-wise in the capital city has been dramatically decreased. And then those who have stayed, in mainly the neighborhoods I named before, because they are primarily Sunni neighborhoods and therefore had more fierce resistance, as I said, those that are remaining here are basically not leaving their neighborhood for fear of their life. As I said, their neighborhoods are completely blocked off, very tightly controlled. Access in and out is extremely limited and very, very cumbersome for the people living there. So in that way, Baghdad has been effectively Balkanized. It's extremely fragmented. And in that way, it's kind of, to an extent anyway, I don't want to draw the analogy too far, but it is actually reminiscent of the country as a whole. We have the Kurds in the north still pushing for their own state. It's almost already like its own country. You almost have to have a visa just to go into Kurdistan at this point. It's that tightly controlled. And then the south is the south, where it's pushing for federalism. Again, if you go down there and don't have someone with you who is from that area, then you're going to be detained by the police and interrogated. That happened to a couple of colleagues of mine a ways back. So in that way, even the country as a whole is extremely fragmented. So when people say, yes, security is better, the reality is we're basically looking at the aftermath of what, in my opinion, has been a very effective policy of turning sides against each other, classic divide and conquer from the U.S. military here. They've been quite effective at that, buying off the awakening groups up in Al-Anbar to have them on their side, at least for the moment. And then groups that they can't control, just effectively doing instigations and turning them against one another. And what's left now is we have a country where one out of six people are displaced from their home. We have over a million people dead. And we have a situation where people, daily life here, people are very, very paranoid. Even though security is, there is a big lull right now. There's still, on average, about a car bomb a day somewhere in Baghdad. But for here, that's considered good security. But people are still going around afraid. You don't know, you don't know about kidnappings. You don't know about car bombs. You don't know if you're going to be pulled over by police and if they'll actually be police or if they're a member of some kind of militia. So that is daily life here. It still is stressful. People are tired. I think that's one of the most common things I've been hearing from Iraqis, whether I'm talking with them about the economic situation or the security situation or any of these things. Consistently, I just keep hearing people say, look, you know, yes, violence is down. We appreciate this lull, but the reality is we're just all very, very tired, and we just want something like a normal life.
Well, what about the refugees who are in Jordan and Syria and other countries? Are they coming home?
They are not overall. Some are. We can say that there are some people slowly trickling back in. But consistently, I think one of the most staggering things I've seen in the last month is relatively recently there was a UNHCR poll conducted of Iraqi refugees in Syria and Jordan. But between those two countries, there's over 2 million Iraqi refugees alone. And in this poll, they asked people, you know, do you ever intend to go back to your homes in Iraq? And over 90% of the people that they surveyed for this poll said they had no intention ever for the rest of their lives of going back to their home.
Now, in the article that you wrote for Tom Dispatch, you go through the history of the awakening movement. And as you, I think, pretty accurately characterize the buying off of what we used to call the evildoers, the Sunni insurgency. Well, I don't think you and I called them that. George Bush called them that. And this is a story that I think kind of went underreported, the turnaround of the main Sunni insurgency against al-Qaeda in Iraq began really in early 2006, and then the Americans finally started paying them to do what they were already doing by late 2006, and this is before Fat Neck Fred Kagan and the rest of these guys came up with the surge plan, right?
That's correct. This was already well underway, well before the surge started, and that's one thing I wanted to make very, very clear in this article, and I spent a lot of time researching this, that the United States, in the aftermath of the very, very fierce resistance that they've been facing from late 2003 until early 2006, decided, okay, we need a different strategy here. And they essentially implemented not their own tactic, but one that was used very effectively by Saddam Hussein to keep control of volatile areas, particularly around Al-Anbar province. Tribal sheikhs are essentially the gods of those areas. They call all the shots. They have tens of thousands of men under each one of their commands. And what Saddam Hussein did, and this was told by me directly, he told my colleagues and then he told me later, Sheikh Affan, a man that I highlight in the article I just published today for Tom Dispatch, and he is the awakening group leader for Fallujah. And I went around with him in the city and I stayed at his house for one night and 2 days and then for a day again on another occasion. And he told me that what Saddam Hussein did was he found these tribal sheikhs and he said, look, I'm going to give you a lot of money in the form of construction contracts. And in that way, I want you to basically keep things under wrap and keep control of your areas so that I don't have to. And that is exactly the strategy that the U.S. pulled out of the closet and has implemented with these awakening groups. They have stood up all of these former resistance fighters. They paid them $300 a month. At one point, the groups totaled approximately 100,000 members across Al-Anbar and Baghdad and parts of Diyala province. And that's the primary reason why violence is down right now, because these men, while the U.S. has stopped paying them off directly, they've, instead of give funding directly to the Awakening groups, they started doing it in the form of so-called construction contracts. So, for example, if we talk about our friend Sheikh Afan, that is the main character in my piece, this is a man who grew up in Saudi Arabia, didn't even come to Iraq until 2001, and then happened to be at the right place at the right time when the U.S. was setting up all of these Awakening groups. He got in with them. He started collaborating. He started giving out names of people in Fallujah, earned the trust of the Americans, and then they started funneling money his way. And so when the Awakening groups were officially disbanded by the United States military in last October, on the promise from the Maliki government that they would roll them into the government security forces, the U.S., instead of stopping paying them, changed the rubric under which they were being paid. So instead of paying Awakening groups, they started saying, okay, these tribal sheikhs are going to be managing construction projects, so we'll be paying them to do reconstruction in their city. Mm-hmm. And so every tribal sheikh who's a member of the Awakening group now is now in the construction business. I got cards from a few of these individuals, and on the bottom of every one of their cards, it says construction, literally, right there on the card. And so we're seeing tens of millions of dollars funneled into the pockets of these sheikhs. Each one of them have their own private militia. Sheikh Afan himself has 900 men at his discretion. He's paying all of them well over $300 a month because his life depends on it. But basically, that's what's happened with U.S. policy here. So the big questions, the open-ended questions here that we're going to see answered over time, I don't know when this is going to start happening, but at some point these questions will have to be answered, and that is what happens with these people and the fact that this game is keeping violence in check for the moment. What are they going to do when all of a sudden that money stops coming? What happens when the U.S. stops funding their so-called construction projects? So is this really an effective policy to improve security, or is it simply a delay tactic that the U.S. is doing to keep a damper on things, at least for the time being? And what's going to happen when that money stops coming?
Mm-hmm. Well, and especially when they're getting all this money and there is no real reconstruction going on. You talk in your article about how Fallujah looks like November of 2004 was the day before yesterday. It's still completely destroyed. There is no reconstruction going on. All that money is being funneled around. And thanks, by the way, because I was wondering, from the articles I'd read, it seemed like the Maliki government wasn't really willing to pay these men, or some of the guys, average foot soldiers in the Awakening Council were showing up and getting paid some money. But certainly they're not, or as far as I can tell, they are not being integrated into the Iraqi military in any real way, and certainly not being put in any kind of leadership position. So it seems like there remains a division of security force power, where in the Sunni provinces, it's basically the Awakening Councils are the government there, and I guess it's kind of fuzzy to the degree to which they really are part of the Maliki government or simply exist beside it.
Well, that's true. And, you know, talking about the situation that you're lining out there in Anbar and in Baghdad are two very, very different things. In Anbar, we can say they're really not part of the government, but after these provincial elections, they are starting to get some political power. So that is shifting there, whereas before they were completely outside the government, now they actually do have some inroads in the government, and these people's intention is to get power in Baghdad, and they're pushing as hard as they can to get that. So that leaves another open-ended question, is what happens a little further down the road, for example, in about a year from now when we have national elections in Iraq, if they're pushing for that power and it doesn't come through. Because I was with Sheikh Afan, as I outlined in the article, where he considered the biggest threat to him in the upcoming elections to be the Iraqi Islamic Party, who was already in power in the province, and he was already going after them, accusing them of fraud, and saying that they would literally take up guns against them if they found out the IIP stole the election. Of course, prefacing that with saying, well, we already have proof that they are. But when we talk about the Awakening groups in Baghdad, that's a really different story, because we've been going around and talking with some of these men here as well. And what's happening is, so far, the Maliki government promised to take in at least 100% of them in Baghdad who are already here. And so far, they've only incorporated 25% of them into the security forces, and we don't see hardly any more being incorporated at this point. And then those that are being incorporated, they're being paid 20, 30, sometimes 50% less than normal Iraqi police and Iraqi army. So there's a very deliberate policy to disenfranchise these people, to anger them, to leave them out in the cold, to really not incorporate them fully into the security forces. And then I can't tell you how many people I've run into who have also, rather than even being paid significant amount of money less than they ought to be paid for their security positions, instead, they're in a situation where they're not being paid at all. But they keep waiting because the government says, look, we're having problems, we're just getting paperwork straight, we are going to pay you. And so these people, with hopes of no other job, keep in mind there's about 50% unemployment in Iraq right now, that these people keep going into their job month after month, and we're talking since October. So we're talking about 4 months now. A lot of these guys are going in and haven't been paid once since the U.S. stopped paying them. So again, when does their patience run out? And I can tell you it's already running out. They're angry. They're bitter. They're saying, look, we've been doing what the government asked us to do. We've been doing what the Americans asked us to do. Now we're not even getting paid. What are we going to do? There's no other jobs, and they're starting to get very, very angry. And so when we talk about the fact that in Baghdad alone, only 25% of all the awakening members have been incorporated into government jobs, we're talking about tens of thousands of armed, militarily trained men, who most of whom used to be resistance fighters, who are getting very, very angry and very, very impatient. So again, that's why I just want to keep underscoring how volatile this situation is. And when people say, well, yes, security is better in Iraq, and Iraq is stabilized, and it looks like it's on its way now after this relatively bloodless election the other week, again, there's so many different trends happening here right now that we can point to that really just underscore the fact that this is an extremely volatile situation. This is a phase of the occupation. It will pass, and a new phase will come. And, you know, there's so many sparks, basically, just or really dry areas waiting for a spark. So that's why it's very volatile and very dangerous, and this situation is anything but resolved.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. When I talk with Patrick Coburn, he basically is saying that America has to leave in 16 months, that the Status of Forces Agreement actually is going to be enforced, and that as cynical as we might be about thinking, you know, yeah, right, as though the Americans intend to abide by it, he's saying it's not up to the Americans anymore. As Maliki said the other day, the era of American dominance in Iraq is over. He can do business with whoever he wants and do whatever he wants. And by the way, you have to leave in 16 months. The Sadrists are, of course, you know, willing to fight for that. I guess they're, for now, seem to be willing to wait out the 16 months. But if the 16 months doesn't happen then, as you say, we're on top of our soldiers are sitting there surrounded by heavily armed men of all different descriptions all over that country. I wonder whether you agree that basically the game is up and America has to go in 16 months, that they just have to no matter what they want to do.
I completely disagree. I mean, let's look at the hard facts on the ground and start there. There's 144,000 American soldiers here. There's over 185,000 private contractors here. There's over 50 American bases here. At least four of them, and possibly more, are called enduring bases. These are absolutely some of the biggest American military bases anywhere on the planet. I was just on the Tigris River interviewing a fisherman a few days ago, and we went by the Green Zone, because that's where his boat launched from, right across from the Green Zone, and I got to see the U.S. Embassy, and so I put some pictures of it up on my website. This embassy is absolutely unbelievable, Scott. When you look at this thing, any thinking person who would look at this thing would say, you know what, there is no way the Americans plan on leaving. This is an absolutely massive compound. It's five stories high, one of the most beautiful buildings in Baghdad, in a heavily entrenched fortress. There's two helipads. I mean, the thing is massive. It's the size of the Vatican City. I'm not exaggerating one bit. And when you couple all of this together and then look at the fact, how many troops are being withdrawn right now from Iraq? Zero. They're talking about an escalation in Afghanistan. They are not talking about hard physical plans to start drawing troops out of Iraq. We already see the legwork in progress of delay tactics. No, maybe the 16-month plan needs to be 19 months. Maybe it needs to be 23 months. Mm-hmm. All of the generals that are still in charge that were under Bush are still here now. They're the ones pushing for the delayed time frame. And again, Scott, and I know that we've talked about this before throughout this occupation, but we have to watch what they're doing. We cannot watch what they're saying. And this is classic politics. And you know, when I talk to Iraqis about this, they say, look, even a school kid here knows this, especially when it comes to politics. You watch what people do. You do not watch what they say. And when you look at what's happening on the ground here, there is irrefutable evidence that there is nothing happening in Iraq today that supports the idea that the Americans are going to withdraw in 16 months. The fact that Maliki can sit up there and beat his chest in response to Joe Biden's remarks and saying we're not going to be pushed around, Maliki knows more than anyone else that his government does not exist without the full backing of the U.S. occupation. So if the U.S. occupation were to pull out immediately, that government would collapse. And that is the reality on the ground here. But again, I want to just keep coming back to the facts that the U.S. military is showing us here on the ground and the Obama administration. And that is that there is no evidence to support that there's going to be a withdrawal of all U.S. forces in 16 months. I just don't see it happening here in Baghdad at all. That, you know, there's patrols all over the place. The bases are not being taken down. Instead, they're being augmented and expanded. This is what we're seeing here on the ground right now.
Well, to the degree that, I mean, you described the martial law situation upon arrival in Baghdad and the walls everywhere and soldiers and security forces there. It seems like, you know, there's a line in there somewhere. I don't know how far we are from it. Maybe it's a million miles away, but it seems at some point, at least, there would be a possibility that the Maliki government could be strong enough and, you know, that have enough bought off loyalty within the new Iraqi army and that kind of thing, that they really don't need us to prop them up anymore. They, after all, the Dawa party, they have their close alliance with the Iranian government next door. And it seems like this was always kind of a mistake from an imperialist perspective in installing, holding elections and installing the majority in power rather than the minority. Because if you prop up the minority, then they need you forever. At some point, though, Maliki will be able to say, get out, I don't need you, right?
Well, that is a possibility, but in everything you said is correct. It's certainly possible, given time, the way certain trends are going right now, that in 2, 3, 4 years that may become a reality. But again, we can only speculate. We're talking about a time that's quite far off in the future. There is no way anytime soon, though, that the Maliki government is going to have enough power to do this. Just using one example, what we kind of covered earlier, look at these Sawa forces. We have tens of thousands of armed, well-trained fighters now that are not being incorporated into the government. So what happens all of a sudden if they decide they need to turn their allegiances against the government and start fighting for themselves and reignite the resistance? So that right there is going to be a massive, massive problem. The Maliki government really is in no way, shape, or form right now anyway, really equipped to handle properly. We're talking 2, 3 years down the line before they could really be in a position where they could say, look, we're demanding the U.S. leave. We want the U.N. to come in, or, you know, we really want true sovereignty. You know, he can talk tough all he wants between now and then, but until he really has the resources on the ground and doesn't have to rely on the U.S. military or U.S. money anymore to keep his government in place, until that point is reached, there's just really, I don't see how the basic structure of the occupation is going to be changed.
Well, that's really unfortunate. Well, doesn't Maliki support depend, especially now with the seeming, as far as I can tell anyway, you know, you're there, not me, but seems like as Dawa and the Supreme Islamic Council split apart, the Dawa party, since they don't have their own army like the Supreme Islamic Council does with the Badr Corps, that they're basically being pushed closer and closer to the Mahdi army, or what's left of it at this point, and are more and more dependent on Iraqi nationalists who reject the pro-federalism, if you call it that, position of the Skiri, or whatever the initials are now, the Supreme Islamic Council. And Sadr's, Muqtada al-Sadr's always really been a hardliner on the nationalist position and on the anti-occupation position. It seems like when you talk about, you know, this is just one time period within the occupation, and to not, you know, read too far into it. That's the first thing I think of is, well, right now Sauter is in Iran getting a higher religious rank and authority, or supposedly studying for one there. But his group hasn't gone away, and now the Maliki government is dependent on him. I don't know to what degree compared to dependent on us, but there's certainly a conflict there, don't you think?
Well, there is, and that's a really good example of how complex the situation is.
I'm sorry, Dar, I lost you for a second there. Can you say that again?
Yeah, it really, you just underscore how complex the situation is. Certain groups. Talk about the Shia. We have the Dawa Party. We have Skiri. We have Muqtada al-Sadr movement. We have the Al-Fadila Party. All of these groups jockeying for power, all of them willing to, if necessary, fight against each other. So again, there isn't cohesion, and this was really even underscored in these recent provincial elections the other week, where full power, and now they've been usurped, and more secular Shia are in power, and so that creates an even more intense power struggle. And then we have, you know, we look even within the...
Ah, geez. Dar, your phone's really cutting out bad. Can you move back to the other side of the room or something? I'm losing you here. Ah, geez. Mic check. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with Dar Jamail. He's in Baghdad right now, having a little bit of cell phone difficulty. I don't think we've lost him entirely there. Dar, can you hear me?
I can, Scott. Are you still there?
Yeah, I can hear you a little better now. Your phone was cutting out there pretty bad. Try again.
Okay. Well, again, I was just discussing about how even within the Shia political parties and religious groups, we have factions. We have a very unstable situation where if we talk about Skiri, we talk about Muqtada al-Sadr and his militia, and we talk about the Dawa Party, we talk about Al-Fadila. All of these groups are completely willing to take up arms against one another. It's a very unstable situation. We look at what's happening with them, and it's really a situation where at any given moment, if one group steps over a line with another group, we're going to have very big problems. So, again, there's that situation, and then when we talk about even within the awakening groups, just to give you another example, when I was up in Al-Anbar province, there were two sheikhs that were very vehemently opposed to one another, basically rivals that have an old blood feud in groups. And one of them was talking, actually the leader of the entire awakening movement, Sheikh Abu Risha, was talking that if this other Sheikh Heist was going with the elections and was playing funny games and committing fraud in the elections, then he was going to turn Al-Anbar into the next Darfur. And this is within the awakening group. So it's very, very volatile. It's very unstable. And, you know, it's a very complex situation. We can't talk about just one group being against another group. But we have to look even within those groups, we're going to see all of these fault lines. And so we're going to have to wait and see. And that's basically where we're at right now. Political jockeying positions being sorted out after the last elections. So this period between now and the national elections scheduled for almost a year from now is going to be a very, very interesting time. And then I think what will be a very telling moment is in that next national election, when we're going to see who comes into power, and then those who do not come into power, how will they be reacting to that?
Mm-hmm. Walden in the chat room is wondering whether the embassy is mentioned in the status of forces agreement. It's pretty clear, you know, when Patrick Coburn broke the story last spring, it had 58 bases in it forever and all this kind of victorious, you know, George Bush's wildest dreams. And apparently by the time they were done getting everybody to agree to it, they even have to submit it to a referendum this July, and all the 58 bases were taken out. Does it address the situation of the embassy, which, again, is like the size of Vatican City, the size of Liechtenstein or something?
The status of forces agreement, I have not read all of the fine print of that entire document, but from what I've seen, All I've seen regarding the embassy is that certain guard positions within the green zone, which was renamed the international zone, that was part of the time period leading up to this so-called SOFA agreement. But one thing I've seen firsthand is that rather than having U.S. soldiers guarding it up front, they have now contractors and or Iraqi forces. And theoretically, U.S. soldiers have to ask permission from Iraqi forces, which, you know, is kind of a bit of a joke because most of the time it doesn't happen, or it comes in the form of a letter saying, okay, we're going to ask you permission for the next year to be able to do this, this, and this. And then the Iraqis say, okay, and everything carries on business as usual. So really what's happened is we have seen the Americans, through this SOFA agreement, do a really good job of putting either a contractor face on the occupation or an Iraqi face on the occupation. So aside from the U.S. patrols, you see it going around Baghdad, and there are quite a few of them. Aside from those, when you go through checkpoints, there are no more U.S. checkpoints in Baghdad. I have not gone through one American military checkpoint, and they're all Iraqi checkpoints or they're all foreign mercenary checkpoints. And the same thing in the so-called international zone. When you go through the 6-7 checkpoints you have to go through to get in there, you will only see American soldiers at the very, very last checkpoint, and even at that, they're off to the side. But that said, I don't know. There may be some information in the SOFA about the embassy. But again, you know, it's called, that's why they call it an embassy. So this is technically not a U.S. base. Granted, it's a massive compound with room for 1,000 employees and has its own full security force. But technically, I wonder if that would even fall under the Status of Forces Agreement, because Status of Forces Agreements, as I understand them, apply specifically to U.S. military bases across the globe. And they have Status of Forces Agreements for all of these bases. So I really do not think that the embassy would fall under that jurisdiction, mainly because it's not technically a U.S. base.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, this goes back to my question about whether America has to stay or go. And, you know, there's always the possibility. I mean, you could argue, I'm sure people did argue, they're not ever going to leave Vietnam. They are determined to have a beachhead in South Vietnam forever. But in fact, they had to leave Vietnam. And with the disgrace on with the helicopters on the roof of the Saigon embassy, you know, saved photographically for all time and that kind of thing. And I guess I wonder if my girlfriend had I dream of genie powers and I could just, you know, zap all the American forces, State Department employees, mercenaries, and everybody else out of Iraq and to, I don't know, Georgia or something, you know, American Georgia, and just in a day and could make them all go. Would the structure, never mind Maliki as prime minister, but would the structure of the government of Iraq as created by the so-called constitution, the elections held there so far under the occupation, would it hold the parliament and the position of president and all that?
Well, right now, especially after these last elections, it is clear that, I mean, Maliki and his group did win quite big in around Baghdad and most of the southern provinces. So as it is right now, they have fairly solidified the power, the grasp on power that they do have. So at least for the moment, and we'll have to wait and see what happens between now and the national elections if something big happens that people would lose faith in the government, you know, but that might change things on how the dynamic would play out for the national elections. However, for right now, they have done a fairly good job at consolidating power, getting more popular opinion on their side. So it's, at least for the moment, it looks like it's going to be holding until the national election.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, Tom Editor there at Tom Dispatch, Tom Englehart, he wrote in the introduction to your essay there at TomDispatch.com today, he talked about Gareth Porter's pieces and what's been coming out from Thomas Ricks from The Washington Post about Petraeus and Odierno and their plan to try to stay forever, but then also to set up the spin for the stab in the back myth, like in Vietnam, that so that if anything, if for any reason, any amount of combat forces are moved out of Iraq, and anything bad happens after that, it'll be the fault of all the anti-war people because Petraeus had it won. Petraeus had everything set perfect until Obama or, you know, Darjamel and Scott Horton and the anti-war movement or whoever came and screwed it up.
Well, Well, I don't, you know, Scott, you caught me on that one. I don't really know even how to respond to that. It's, you know, what can we say? As journalists, we do our job. We report on what's happening on the ground. When asked our opinion about things, we give our opinion, but otherwise we simply report on what we see happening. And, you know, as journalists, that's all that we can do. And, if, you know, people can take that or leave it. And if they don't like that information, then I guess I don't know what to tell them. But, you know, the reality is the reality here on the ground in Iraq. We can look at U.S. policy. That speaks for itself. We can look at how that's playing out on the ground here with the bases and how many troops are here and the over 600 Western contractors, companies, that, corporate companies that operate on the ground here today. We look at how this is affecting the Iraqi people. And all of this is hard facts, hard reality. There's no opinion in this whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So we report on that. That's our job. And people then have to just deal with that information however they feel that they need to deal with it.
Well, I'm sorry, but the problem here is that you're dealing in far too great of detail. And what matters in the conflict over policy in America is broad narratives. And either we're winning or we're losing, or we could have won but we didn't, or we're winning now but if we leave then we'll lose, or, you know, if we leave now then we'll win, or whatever. These are the only things that count in determining whether we stay or leave. And as you know, it's been this paradox where the worse things get, the more they say, well, we can't leave now because think how bad it'll be then. And then when the security situation improves at all and violence is down, then they say we can't leave now because it'll get worse again. So somehow there's got to be a concrete refutation of that paradox.
Well, absolutely there is, and I think you just kind of lined out the paradox. And, you know, at the end of the day, we can come down to the fact that Iraq is not a state of the United States. The United States, theoretically, under international law, cannot have a say in whatever happens in Iraq. And the reality is that over 71% of Iraqis are in favor of a total withdrawal. And when we look at a Maliki administration now here, who is saying, yes, we are going to stick to the 16-month timetable, we're not going to be pushed around, et cetera, that's what's happening here on the ground. And, you know, all of the rhetoric about, well, the U.S. has done so much damage, they have to stay there and try to repair it because it's the moral thing. I mean, I can understand the well-meaning intentions behind that, but the reality is this has been an absolute catastrophe for the Iraqi people, and that's why over 71% favor total withdrawal. Damn the consequences. And if that's what the Iraqi people want, and if Iraq is theoretically a sovereign nation under international law, then that's what should be happening. It's technically nobody's business in the United States, whether it's you, me, or the president, or Congress people, or different lobby groups. No matter what we think should happen in Iraq, it's none of our business because this is not our country. It's the Iraqi people's country, and what they want to have happen is what should happen. And we've already been very clear about what the vast majority of people in this country want to see, and that is a full, total withdrawal of all occupation forces in less than a year's time, and that was from a poll taken last September.
Mm-hmm. Who's the 30%, Dar?
Well, the remaining 29%, interestingly, 15% of those still favored total withdrawal also, but only until security improved and then held. And then the remaining percent, what does that leave? About 14%, I believe, if my math is correct. The remaining percent were predominantly the Kurds up in the north, which make up about 20% of the population, so it's not even all of the Kurds. But the brunt of the Kurds, of course, are in full favor of ongoing U.S. occupation because, frankly, their survival depends on it.
Well, what will happen to them if America leaves and the country is again dominated by Arabs? There's going to be a total bloodbath and war over the oil land up there, or what? What are they afraid of?
No, I think it's a question. I think it's a question of greed, because when you look at the two Kurdish leaders, Jalal Talabani and Barzani, we have a situation where these guys are getting filthy rich off of the occupation. They're signing contracts. They want the U.S. bases there because they feel that that's going to help them progress towards a more independent Kurdistan. I think things would stay the same for the Kurds if the U.S. were to withdraw, and that's not what the Kurds want. The Kurds want independence. They want to expand their territory. They are pushing for a greater Kurdistan, which extends even beyond the borders of the area they control now in northern Iraq, and they feel that the U.S. bases in their area safeguard at least what they have. So things would stay the same for them, and that's not what they want, their leaders, that is. They want more money, they want more contracts, they want to expand their borders, and they're heavily, heavily dependent on the U.S. military remaining there in order for them to further that agenda.
All right, everybody, that's Dar Jamail, unembedded reporter, live on the phone from Baghdad. He's the author of the book Beyond the Green Zone. His website is darjamailiraq.com, and you can find his anti-war archives at antiwar.com/Jamail. It's J-A-M-A-I-L. Thanks very much for your time on the show today.
Thank you, Scott.
So the other day, Christmas Day, I got up Christmas morning and I was watching TV.
It's chaos in Austin.
Things going on. And I said, wait a minute, this is Christmas. Peace on earth. What happened to all that stuff, you know? So here's what... So many things going on in the world. Babies dying, mothers crying. How much oil is one human life worth? And what happened to peace on earth? We believe everything that they tell us. They're gonna kill us, so we gotta kill them first. How much is that soldier's life? And what happened to peace on earth? And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. And how much is a liar's word worth? And what happened to peace on earth? I guess it's just due on the others. You won't hear this song on the radio, probably. Not on your local TV. But if you're inclined and you ever have time, you can always hear it from me. And the bewildered herd still believe it. Everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me. Not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And what happened to peace on earth?
All right, everybody. It's Anti-War Radio on Chaos. Some old Willie Nelson for you on the show. So I got some news stories to cover, like always, but I want to hear from you guys. It's been a while, and there are some people out there, so I figure maybe some of you guys want to take part in the show. So why don't you call in? The phone number is 512-646-6446. 512-646-6446, and maybe we can have a conversation. I'll interview you and you interview me. And, you know, I guess if I was a properly trained talk radio show host, I would come up with a question and pretend I didn't know the answer to it. Hey, guys, what do you think about this contest between Benjamin Netanyahu and Zippy Livni and their contest for who's going to be able to create a coalition government and become Prime Minister of Israel? I can't think of a thing to say about it. Why don't you guys call in and tell us what you think? Is that how you do it? Is that, I need to practice. Or actually, I think the way you're supposed to do it is, hey, did you guys see that thing in the Metro and State section today that didn't mean anything at all? Was of no relevance to anyone's life, of no importance, of no relevance to any other thing even. Let's talk about that for 3 hours. That's how you're supposed to do it. I need to practice. But for now, anyway, I guess I'll continue to just do it my way. Let's talk about the Israeli elections It's an interesting, very complex situation the way they have it over there. You vote for the party. Oh, did I need to say the number again? I bet I should say the number some more. 512-646-6446. 512-646-6446. And especially you guys in the chat room, you better call and not make a jackass out of me asking for calls and giving out the number and not getting any. All right, good. So, yeah, there we go. That's what I'm talking about. So, yeah, it's an interesting situation over there because you vote for the party, not the person, although you know who the leader of the party is and who's likely to become prime minister. But then the president gets to pick who gets first shot at creating a coalition government, whether their party came in first or not. Anyway, it's neck and neck. I forget. I think the last vote total said that the Likud party of Benjamin Netanyahu was a little bit ahead of Kadima, but it's... I'm not so sure, so certain that that is resolved. I guess the real question is, what difference does it make? Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. This is Troy.
Hey, Troy. How's it going?
Good. I was listening to your interview of Lou Rockville the other day, and I was thinking more interviews about economics would be a more basics of economics would be good. In particular, see all these liberals, a lot of their arguments against it. They, what was the one? Oh, there is, you hear liberals are, at least people that are broadly defined as the left will argue, for the welfare state, and particularly ones outside the United States will, they'll go against the whole idea of welfare warfare state because they say, well, the United States is, well, that's just a bad example, or even the Soviet Union's a bad example, but, you know, say, countries say like Sweden or Norway or Denmark or really the rest of Western Europe, that's the way socialism works. That's how you're supposed to do it. So, more topics about, you know, how they, I know that gets away from the anti-war thing, but,
Well, no, it's all one big topic, really, and, of course, with the financial crisis the way it is now, and, disagreeing with virtually everyone in the way I do, you know, it's certainly something that I want to talk about more, on the show. It's unfortunate that people always leave out of the discussion about those Northern European countries that, yeah, but who pays for their military? We do. And how much socialism could they afford without the American taxpayer financing NATO? They had to take care of their own borders.
Yeah, that's definitely part of the whole, with over 50% of defense funding in the world is supported by the United States. I don't even know if that counts to arms sales. I know the U.S. is also the biggest arms dealer in the world, and but the next lowest is what U.K. or Israel, something like that.
You know, I don't know who's next on the list, but I know America spends about as much as the rest of the world combined. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's a little bit less. But, yeah, in fact, a lot of that spending is to protect regimes in other people's countries. You won't catch me, or I hope you don't catch me slipping and you know, referring to the people as being the ones who made the deal or anything like that. But the governments, particularly of Europe and, of course, all over Asia, excluding China and Vietnam and a couple of others, are heavily reliant on that spending. It's what Justin Raimondo talks about in his articles, that that's our division of labor in the new global economy. We're the thugs. The Chinese, you know, manufacture the finished goods and people further south, you know, come up with the raw materials, and we're the ones who go around with machine guns and napalm killing everybody who doesn't fall into line.
Yeah, well, that's quite a system they got there.
yeah, it's beautiful. And it's really endearing the rest of the world to us, too.
Well, everybody's got a job, I guess. I've been trying to find... I found a little bit about like some of those like Sweden and some of the about how they're not so great. But do you know of a lot of articles or anybody does a lot of work that knows about you know how much they're able to fund their whole socialist state because of the United States?
You know, I don't really know who's done a lot of work at that. I'm sure you could start at Mises.org. I really don't know specifically. I know that I've met Swedes in my life who say that they absolutely hate it, and I've also met Swedes who say socialism is great. 60% taxation is fine because everything's free. You know, like, okay, whatever. And here's the thing, too, and this is an argument that I think libertarians and liberals and conservatives and really any thinking person can agree on, is that we need to decentralize authority. And so if people in New Hampshire want to secede from the union and everybody walks around with guns on their hips and no seatbelt laws and whatever they want, that's fine. And if people in Massachusetts, assuming people within America can still, you know, flee across borders and whatever, if they want to have a more of a welfare state, that's fine. And the thing is, those differences I think we need to accentuate and stop having the one-size-fits-all thing. I have a friend who I'm constantly arguing with about democracy and liberty, but she's got this built-in flaw, which is she's from Switzerland, which is probably the most successful putting together of a decentralized federal republic with a peaceful foreign policy and a market economy that has probably ever been created. It's the most successful example of a human government in the world, probably. And so, of course, her answer is, yeah, but it doesn't, like you said, it doesn't have to be that way. That's just America. Over in Europe, we know how to do it right and whatever. And, you know, I wouldn't know because I'm not from Europe. I don't know how to compare Switzerland to the rest of the countries there and what have you. I know that they have a lot less wars. But I know for a fact there that almost all the actual governing that takes place is on a very local level. And, you know, I don't prefer local tyranny, really, but obviously the more local it is, in many cases, I guess depending on the culture, the more liberty you're going to have, the greater the ability of the regular person to put their government in check. And we keep, everybody keeps wanting to try out all their great ideas as a social experiment on the rest of us from Washington, D.C., where there's no escape from it. And it obviously just sows catastrophe. So I say, you know, at the very least, you don't even have to go as far as me and say, you know, repeal the Constitution and go back to the Articles of Confederation. What about just going by the Constitution? What about actually having federalism in America again and decentralization? There's no reason that all the states should have to do everything the same way.
I know with the Green Party, all them, they started to go on that tack where they're focusing more on local matter. I know they're not libertarian by any means, but that's how they go with their goals. I know, was it, I've read a little bit about Switzerland. I don't know a lot about Switzerland, but I know it's, well, from what little bit I've read, it hasn't been like quite as great as a lot of people think. I know it was, there was some special on PBS where they actually had, this is PBS trying to get Americans to go on with socialized medicine, and they had, I know Switzerland was one of the ones that ended up instituting it, and by what I've seen, they had the civil war in Switzerland. I'm by no means an expert, so maybe someone to call in will set me right, but like the civil war in Switzerland in, I think it was the 1840s, actually set it up so it too was more of a centralized state like the United States. It hasn't become as centralized as the U.S. So I guess even Switzerland is far from a perfect example. So that's maybe why your friend is kind of mistaken in her view. Maybe that's part of how she came to those conclusions.
Yeah. Well, you know, her thing is that to an American, especially me, taxation is simply theft at gunpoint. But that there's really a lot less of that perspective over there because people can really see, or at least they think they can really see where their money's going to. And for the most part, they approve of it. And so they really don't mind, you know, losing an election this time because they get to run next time and try their way next time, whatever. And that apparently they feel that there's enough accountability that they're willing to tolerate it. It's certainly not the case here. I'm not willing to tolerate the level of accountability in this country. I don't think anybody should be. Thanks for calling in, man. I really appreciate it, Troy.
Yeah, no problem. Bye.
Take care. All right, folks, it's 512-646-6446. 512-646-6446. Why don't you call on the show and we can talk about whatever you like. Yeah, economics. Did I tell you guys, I was watching on TV the other day and they were talking about the economic crisis, and I think the here in California, I'm new, man. I don't really know exactly how it goes, but something like a $50 billion deficit. Now, in Texas, they can't have a deficit. In Texas, they must have a balanced budget. I don't know what the law is around here, but it seems like a major crisis and huge numbers of government job holders being laid off, which is ultimately for the best of everyone, but of course is extremely disruptive to their lives and can be disruptive to the whole society in the short run. You know, the depth of this, and really I guess you guys have all been watching the numbers of unemployment statistics coming in and numbers of layoffs, and it really is a catastrophe. And Troy's right that it's time to really focus on that and try to get a better understanding across to people of how that works. And to that end, I plan on interviewing mostly economists I agree with, but also I want to host a couple of debates and things like that on the radio and see if we can, you know, try to get the lesson across to some people. I think it's really easy. You don't have to agree with me on anything else. You know, it doesn't matter what your ideological perspective is. The thing is, the good times that we thought were good times was an artificial high. That's what it was. It was like being drunk and having a great time, greater than you're really having. And then the next day you got a splitting headache. Lou Rockwell gave the metaphor up on the show, or simile, or whichever it is, last week, and he's exactly right. The recession is the transition period from an overinflated, artificial, bubble, high economy back down to the level of reality. And it's not government that's doing it. It's the market that's doing it. It's the market that is refusing to any longer tolerate the distortions forced upon it by the state. And that's why they call it a correction. And so it is terribly disruptive. In fact, one of the clips I saw was all the construction workers in California. Here, this was the state with the biggest housing boom, the most foreclosures, and there's just no private construction going on, very, very little, certainly compared to how many people were in the construction business at the height of the boom, the artificially high boom. And now they are protesting. I saw on the news in downtown Los Angeles saying they want a budget that includes a bunch of new state construction projects, because that's basically the only work that could possibly be available for construction firms as prices try to settle back down to where they belong. And so obviously that's bad economics, just taking from other people to keep certain people employed and doing what they're doing, when clearly the resources are not there. They have to use force to get them. That's not the best way to handle it, but of course you can see their perspective. The construction business has gone completely to dirt. And it's all the fault of fractional reserve banking. It's because of the paper money in your pocket. Now, if that paper money in your pocket said it was redeemable in gold and really meant it, that would be different. Doesn't matter that it's paper. What matters is that it's just paper. And when the government creates new paper money, they create bubbles. They create the business cycle, the boom and bust cycle that they claim their purpose is to smooth out, to benefit all mankind. They are the cause of it. The people with the power in D.C., they set the reserve ratios that tell banks how much fraud they're allowed to commit. They set the interest rates that tell banks how cheap money is or how expensive. And they are the ones who cause a bubble that private free market capitalism in its wildest of excesses can never reproduce. It's the Federal Reserve Bank. That's the reason you're out of work. It's because government controls the money. They manipulate the economy. And they suck at it. All right. Somebody dropped off there. I was going on so long-winded they didn't want to hear anymore, but somebody's still here. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show, if that's you. Oh, wait a minute. Hang on 1 second. Now that's you.
Hey, this is Perger.
Hey, Perger. How's it going, man?
Hey, doing all right, man. Just firstly want to say congrats on you and your relocation.
Oh, cool. Hey, thanks. Yeah, I'm having a great time out here. It's really nice. In-N-Out Burger rules. They need to expand those. I guess now's not the time to expand franchises. But back when it's the next time there's an artificial boom going on, they ought to expand that thing out to Texas. I feel bad for all my friends that cannot eat them. They are good, good.
Yeah, and also for what it's worth as far as just trying to remind people to donate to the website Anti-War. I mean, it's a great website, so people, please donate.
Either. Hey, thanks, man. That's cool of you to say.
Yeah, I know I'm not a salesman. My dad was a salesman, but not me. So I'm not that good. But mainly what I wanted to call about, since you got on the whole economic topic, which really works in my favor, I was talking to my wife. My wife, she's somewhat of an accountant, so she was doing our taxes. And I hate to say, like, my taxes, right? That's how they got people saying it. But we did our income taxes last night, and I was just looking at it, and she was saying how we owe. And it really bothers me, is what I'm saying. And it's hard sometimes to make people understand how taxes really don't benefit them. Well, how it, like you say, it's a coercive thing. It's like, I think it was on one of the interviews, it was one of the speakers on Mises.org I was listening to once. And he said that taxes were nothing but highway robbery in a sense, because they just take your money and they say, okay, we're going to give you something, but whether you like it or not, we're still going to take your money. You know what I'm saying?
That's right. They're the security service you can't fire. I think it was originally Lysander Spooner, the great abolitionist, who said that at least a highwayman has the respect to leave you alone after he mugs you, whereas what the government really is, they're like the highwayman who then after he mugs you and beats you over the head, then he follows you home and camps out in your front yard and calls himself your security service because if it wasn't for him, somebody might mug you.
Yeah, exactly. And something else I was thinking about, too, is there's, I forget what you call it, a contradiction or something, but there's a company, and I'm not trying to advertise any companies here, but the name of the company is Liberty Taxes, and they do people's income taxes. And I was thinking about the craziness and how it's like two opposite meanings, right? I mean, one is slavery and the other one is saying freedom. So it's like they're helping you be free by helping you give your money to the state. I don't understand that, but
yeah. Well, you know, those are the most popular terms in advertising. They'll say any substance that they're selling you, they will say it is this or that free, meaning it just doesn't have that in it. But the real point is to drive home that word, F-R-E-E, human eyes love that. Well, English reading ones see that word and think, yeah, freedom. And it goes right to our core. And so that's why they say this is sodium free or cholesterol free or whatever free. It's just so they can tell you free, free, free.
Yeah,
it's even better than new as far as brainwashing people into buying your stuff. So, yeah, liberty taxes, why not? I mean, if liberty is the society and the society is the state and the state is a gun to your head taking money out of your wallet, then liberty and a gun to your head taking money out of your wallet are, in fact, the same thing. Why not? You know, why not just make that leap?
Yeah, and so many people don't catch it, and I guess that was mainly it. It's just me and my disgust for the whole tax situation. It really does bother me, and it's just more or less I tell people about it, but everyone, as far as they're concerned, most people feel like they can't do anything. And there's something that I heard also. It was at one of the audiobooks on Mises.org, and when people hear about fighting back against the state, most people think it has to be some sort of armed rebellion type deal. But the truth about it is the government, of course, doesn't have this power unless people are serving it. Most people have to serve it. So in that regard, you don't have to do any sort of armed rebellion. All you have to do is just stop serving. You know, and I know I'm not saying any armed rebellion here on the radio, but I'm just saying it.
I ain't scared. Whatever. No, the point is that you're right. I mean, this is my strategy. I don't know what to do except just deny them legitimacy. They're not legitimate. Why is it legitimate for somebody to hold a gun to my head and mug me or to do it to you either? It's not. Simple as that, and I don't mind saying it, and I think that's really the best strategy is, you know, we got to get the American people on our side. The American people, for example, believe that capitalism caused the problem and government's the only solution. They believe that freedom causes all the problems and turning over authority over all our decisions to centralized power is the right way to go, then certainly government is going to get away with much worse. And so, you know, I see it as my role anyway to just cast aspersions on them. They happen to deserve it. They happen to be the biggest, you know, most violent government since World War II anyway. Well, the biggest ever and the most violent since the worst days of World War II. So it's pretty easy to oppose them. It's pretty easy to deny them legitimacy that they clearly don't have.
Yeah, completely. That's where I'm coming from. And,
hell yeah.
And I'll go ahead and leave it right there. But like I said, you're doing great work, and thanks for trying to tell everyone.
Hey, thanks a lot for calling in, man. Really appreciate it.
All right, man. No problem. Bye.
All right, y'all. Anti-War Radio taking a couple of calls. Hey, look, Pupnik joined. Hey, Pupnik, can you call from Germany? Pupnik lives in Germany, I think. Oh, yeah. Did I tell you guys about the, what you call it? Chat room. If you go to my blog, it's thestressblog.com. There's green writing on the front right-hand side of the page there. And if you follow them, their instructions, all you do is get Chatzilla for your Mozilla. And then go to Freenode is one of the chat channel things and search for anti-war radio. Pupnik, I think, set it up, him or Mike L. or somebody. Anyway, a lot of people hang out and chit-chat back and forth in there during the show. And so, yeah, could be you. Taking some more calls. Here is David in Michigan. Somehow the thingamajiggy knew his name. Welcome to the show.
You got me?
Yeah, you're here. How's it going?
Good. Enemy of the state here. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. I can't believe you dropped another cliffhanger on us the other day saying you got some big news that you can't tell us yet.
Sorry about that.
When are you going to be able to tell us what the news is? That's the question. Any idea?
I don't know. And the thing is, what's funny is I was going to tell everybody, but then I was warned, don't jinx it. So I'm not jinxing anything. I'm just doing the show.
Gotcha, man. Wanted to ask you about, I came across something pretty cool the other day. I'm not real comfortable with using the term anarchist. I don't call myself a libertarian. I don't really like calling myself an anarchist because of the reaction that it gets from people when you discuss it with them, right?
Yeah, they imagine things on fire, basically.
Exactly, right. I mean, you say anarchist, they roll their eyes. They see chaos, war in the street, everybody killing each other for bread, you know, all that kind of stuff.
That's what I see when people say government, but anyway.
Exactly. But there's an article on Strike the Root, which I just kind of picked up on the other day, and he likes the term abolitionist. And I thought, hey, that's pretty darn good. I can work with that term. Basically, you know, it has a good connotation to it that people associate it with abolition of slavery and whatnot. And what you're saying is that, you know, you embrace the Declaration of Independence where it says that the people have a right to alter or abolish it. And that's what I kind of like that term. I just go tell people I'm an abolitionist, which the other day I told it to a guy, and he said, does that mean I'm against alcohol?
That's
what do you think of the term?
Yeah, you've got to make sure and keep the idea separate there.
Yeah.
Make sure. No, I'm not a teetotaler. In fact, I'm drunk right now. I'm just telling you. Well, you know, I saw some people said they call themselves non-archists instead of anarchists because they don't want to be confused with anarcho-lefties, who I think, you know, I don't mind being confused with anarcho-lefties. They're nice folks anyway. Who cares?
Yeah, they're confused socialists.
Yeah, I mean, if they put lefty first, that's a problem. But as long as anarcho's first, hey, who can really argue with that? Not me.
Yeah.
But anyway, right, yeah, I like that. And in fact, you know, that's like the Lysander Spooner thing. I mean, here was a guy who, well, first of all, was one of the greatest abolitionists of his day in terms of private slavery, who was a Northerner, who opposed the Civil War, the Northern invasion of and conquering of the South, and also wrote that awesome treatise, No Treason. And I remember the first time I heard of that, I thought, eh, it sounded almost like a populist right-wing kind of thing where they accuse anybody who doesn't agree with them of being guilty of treason. And I thought, oh, you know, no treason. No, no. Then I read it, and it said, no, no, no. No treason means, how could I possibly be guilty of treason when I never owed you any allegiance in the first place, spit. And I thought, yeah, I like this guy. And he goes through, and I guess it's part 5 or 6 or something, is called The Constitution of No Authority, where he states the simple case that we all thought of the first time we ever learned about government in our, you know, second grade civics class or wherever, the very first introduction to it. How can a bunch of people from 200 and something years ago sign me up for a contract?
Exactly.
Your great-great-great-grandfather has the right to sign me up for a contract?
Yeah,
I don't buy it. And we all think of that, but we sort of just go along with, oh, popular sovereignty and we the people and all that we know is BS, we know is not true, when in fact, your great-great-grandfather doesn't have the right to sign me up for a contract any more than I have the right to sign you up for a contract right now.
Right. And I think, didn't even Jefferson, I think, express that sentiment.
Right, yeah, that's what he said there, although he was still going with the theory of popular sovereignty, but he was saying it should go only a generation at a time and that each generation ought to be able to hold a new constitutional convention and work things out their own way.
Yeah, hey, speaking of constitutional conventions, I've been hearing lately, it's in kind of the conspiracy circles, or at least people who lean that way, I guess, that so many states are already calling for one, and they're only so many states away from another constitutional convention. You heard any of this talk?
Well, here's what I know about it. I know that back in the 70s, there was a big push, mostly centered around the Equal Rights Amendment, which ended up expiring and becoming no longer an issue. But the state legislatures, basically all they have to do, according to, I think it's Article 5 or 6, I forget, of the Constitution, explains that they can, the way that the Constitution can be amended is either they get two-thirds majorities, pass them out of Congress and to the states, or the states, any of the state legislatures, I believe, can initiate one. And then once they get three-quarters, and it works either way, the numbers are three-quarters of the states and two-thirds of the houses of Congress, in either direction, the states can come up with it or the Congress can come up with it, but they need that much to amend the Constitution. But by that same standard, though, rather than a specific amendment, if three-quarters of the states call for a constitutional convention, then it's on. And it's to be, I believe, the power to create it goes to the Congress that exists now. But then they have, basically, they could create a constitutional convention that gives ultimate authority to rewrite any part of it that they want. And, you know, of course, anybody with power would probably like to, you know, or at least has their own idea of what the Constitution ought to be that includes a lot more power for them.
Yeah, it's a real scary thought, isn't it? Can you imagine that they are thinking of rewriting the Constitution that has anything more to do with individual liberty than the old one that they ignore?
Yeah, well, and see, that's the whole thing, is, well, first of all, there was a movement on the populist right. I think the John Birch Society led it, at least in the 1990s, and it could go back further than that, where they went around educating state legislatures about this and convinced at least, I don't know, maybe even a dozen of them or something, at least a good handful of them, to rescind their petition for a constitutional convention because they were getting very close. And maybe it's two-thirds, not three-quarters. I could be confused about that. I think it's three-quarters, though. But they were getting, you know, within 5 or 10 state legislatures petitioning for a constitutional convention before it would have happened or, you know, could have happened. And so they were successful in getting some of those repealed, but then apparently there's been a regression, and some state legislatures have passed resolutions calling for conventions since then. And I don't know exactly what the numbers are now, but here's my gut on the thing. You just said it. They ignore the Constitution we have, while in fact it still is what creates their authority and their legitimacy. Article 1, Article 2, Article 3, basically all it says in any of those is that there can be a Congress, there shall be a Congress, there shall be a president, there shall be a court, and the rest of it is meaningless. They can do anything that they want. It's their perfect cover. They have Thomas Jefferson and the American flag and Betsy Ross and Francis Scott Key and Thomas Paine and all their symbols and slogans of freedom and revolution and good government and whatever the hell from 220 years ago. Why throw that away?
Yeah.
In favor of a constitution that people would actually want to read and pay attention to what was happening to them and maybe even fight over it and whatever. So I kind of think that from the point of view of the establishment, they wouldn't want a constitutional convention. Why bother? They got the biggest government in the whole world. If you
right,
told James Madison that this was the constitution he wrote, he would laugh in your face. It's a good thing he's dead, because actually probably hurt your ears, he'd be laughing so loud. You know, so basically, it's the kind of thing that technically could be a worry, but I personally don't think it's that much of a problem, because I can't see them really trying to overthrow their cloak of legitimacy, the last bit of it that they have.
Yeah, you know, I look at it from two angles, and I'm kind of confused on the whole thing. First of all, I wonder what's even motivating the states to do such a thing. I mean, they're so subservient to the federal government in the first place. I mean, you know, it's completely upside down from it, how it was designed. I remember I live in Michigan, and the governor here, they messed with their whole convention the voting process and the preliminary voting process there. I lost my term. Anyway, they messed it up and moved their whole date around and everything, and her wording was, you know, that Michigan needs a friend in the White House, you know, that we're going to have somebody who will give us more welfare here. So what could possibly be, that's one of my questions, what could possibly be the motivation of the states to call for a constitutional convention? And yeah, the other angle is...
I have no idea. I don't know what the hell is going on there. I mean, seriously, you're right. I guess, you know, I can imagine where populist right-wing types are mad and want to, you know, I don't know, figure out a way to add teeth to the 10th Amendment or something in order to make it harder to centralize government. They've just picked a really bad tactic. I'm just making that up. I can sort of imagine that. And I guess, you know, again, the Equal Rights Amendment, there was a big push in the 70s where, you know, the most politically incorrect thing of all was the Founding Fathers, and it was time to go ahead and, you know, enshrine Washington, D.C. as the ultimate ruler of every transaction in the country without limit. And, you know, that was pushing for big enough changes that I guess maybe just tactically they figured they couldn't get it done by way of just an amendment, so they wanted to get a convention and rewrite it. However, it seems like the kind of thing that would be pushed by smaller interest groups, you know, rather than by the establishment. But I'm only guessing at that. I really don't know.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it seems to me, you know, I don't know. I mean, the way I look at it is this. The Constitution is a disaster. But it's got that Bill of Rights on it. And what I want to see is not, you know, it being replaced by something worse. I'd like to just see it repealed, and we'll go by default back to the Articles of Confederation and work on privatizing all the property from there. You know, but I certainly don't want to see, you know, every power monger and lobbyist and lunatic in this country trying to rewrite my Bill of Rights. That's got to be the last thing to go, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And from the establishment perspective, I mean, as you said, they successfully do whatever they want in spite of the Constitution anyway. So what motivation do they have to change it, other than, you know, where it pesters them just too much, and they've got those pesky Constitution problems to deal with? Maybe they'd like to remove some of them, but I mean, they do just fine running their government by rule of man the way they want to.
Yeah. I don't know what's stopping them now. I mean, Barack Obama has proved to anybody who doubted it at all that he's giving a complete blank check of immunity. Not that he has authority to do so beyond just his basic pardon power, but he is guaranteeing in law permanently that any president may murder, may break any law without limit, may break the most important laws without limit and suffer no consequences. And, you know, so, and they're getting away with still pretending that this is the same constitution as that and whatever. You know, they're getting away with pretending that Nancy Pelosi's responsibility wasn't to remove these people from power, that the Justice Department wasn't being run by, in fact, you know, the torturers. And that's another thing. You know, the Democrats in the Senate, they confirmed Alberto Gonzalez to be the Attorney General after they knew he was the torture memo guy. I mean, boy, you talk about how obviously stinkingly corrupt this whole system, this imperial system has become, and the fact that they still get to get away with calling it the Constitution of 1789. If I was them, I certainly wouldn't be even trying to bring the Constitution to anyone's attention at all, because I think you get down to it, most Americans don't know what's in there, but they know it's important to them. They know they'd be worse off without it, or they think at least that things would be that power against them would be even more arbitrary and unfair without it than it is with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, that's
all right,
me.
Dad. Hey, thanks a lot, Scott. I'll talk to you later. It's good to have you back on, bro.
Hey, thank you. I should ask you questions. You ask me a question, I'll just go on and on, but that's the way it is. All right, so I'm Scott. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm on Chaos in Austin. The phone number is 512-646-6446, 512-646-6446. Talk about anything you want, really. Ask me anything you want or comment on whatever you want. Someone asked me in the chat room, someone was wondering whatever happened to Sabelle Edmonds and how come she didn't just go ahead and talk, or why doesn't she now that Bush is gone? Well, she did talk. She gave her story, and we talked about this with her on the show at the time. She was willing to tell her whole story, regardless of the possible felony prosecution for violating her state secrets gag order, and as long as they would put her on TV without editing out all the important stuff. And they wouldn't do it. She was willing to go on any of the American TV networks, and none of them would bite. And so she ended up talking to The Times in London, which ran a 3 or maybe even 4 part, because the 4th part kind of went off on a tangent, but still, I guess you'd consider it a 4 part thing. If I remember that right, maybe it was just 3. I don't know. Anyway, it was The Times of London. If you just Google Times of London and Sabelle Edmonds, you'll find it. And I interviewed, real nice guy, who helped write the articles. Does anybody remember the name of that guy that helped write the articles in the Times? And I interviewed him here on the show. He also writes for the Huffington Post. So they wrote that thing in the Times, and that's where you can find out as much of the story as been published, major sources. And then, of course, there's this show and the work of Luke Ryland at letsabelleedmondspeak.blogspot.com. And there's her rogues gallery. She's banned from talking, but she released pictures of a bunch of people who she overheard being criminals. All kinds of interesting stuff. If you look into that story, it's a hell of a thing. And I don't know what's going to happen. Apparently nobody wanted to prosecute her for talking to the Times. They just would rather pretend that the whole thing doesn't exist, because of course it involves Republicans and Democrats. It involves, parts of the FBI breaking the law. In fact, even the information that she was getting was stuff, I think, or at least she knows certainly that some of the wiretap stuff, whether it was the stuff she was listening to or not, I'm not exactly certain at this point. I think I used to know. But at least some of the FBI's wiretap stuff, that she's discussing here, came from illegal warrants, came from FISA warrants, under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, when they really weren't wiretapping agents of a foreign power. They really were doing basically criminal investigations, but they were doing it under intelligence authority and breaking the law. And so a lot of this evidence that they had against these criminals can't be used, because it's in a court because it's come from a much lower threshold of evidence required to get the warrant. I believe the FISA court's level of evidence that they need to be satisfied is either an objective reasonable belief or a reasonable suspicion, or maybe not even reasonable, maybe just suspicion. I'm not sure if it even has reasonable in it. It's certainly lower than probable cause, which is the threshold to violate the rights of Americans as stipulated in the Fourth Amendment to the American Constitution. So that's a big part of it. You got Republicans and Democrats. You got FBI agents. You have literally the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, Dennis Hastert. You have high-level political appointees in the Clinton and Bush administration, in the State Department, in the Defense Department. And these guys are involved in selling nuclear secrets, in blackmail, in the same crime rings that launder money for the worst drug dealers, you know, heroin traffickers on earth, for terrorists. It's in fact the same black market economy that Loretta Napoleoni talks about in her book Terror Inc., which is so important. I ought to interview her again. She's an Italian reporter. And she says that the underground heroin smuggling slash terrorism slash, you know, black market, money laundering, whatever sort of crime rings in the world make up tens of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, actually, even, I think she says, in the world economy. And that to, say, for example, legalize heroin and let its price fall through the floor and put a lot of, you know, dangerous terrorist type groups, therefore, out of business would be too much. It would cause absolute catastrophe. I mean, hell, maybe now that we have absolute economic catastrophe, this would be a good time to go ahead and bankrupt the terrorists. Go ahead and legalize heroin. I don't think they should legalize selling nuclear weapons secrets, though. I'm not so certain whether that just goes under, you know, regular free trade theory or what, but anyway, it's a hell of a story. You know, Sybelle Edmonds, she was just not even FBI agent, just a contractor, got hired to help translate their wiretaps after September 11th. And her whole squad, her bosses, other FBI agents have testified in front of Congress that she's right, that they know what she's saying is true. They corroborate her. Senator Grassley corroborated her story. The Inspector General of the Justice Department in the declassified released summary of his report on her case verified that, yeah, there's nothing wrong with what she's saying other than that it's a secret, man. And in fact, you know, stipulate that she was run out of her job at the FBI simply for telling the truth, simply for going around her corrupt supervisors and to their supervisors in order to point out that, hey, we have some of the highest level criminality you could imagine going on here, and Holmes doesn't even care. And hell, she had an agent of a foreign power working there as a translator with her in the office, a lady named Melek Dickerson, who was part of the American Turkish Council, which is just a front for AIPAC and the arms industry in this country. Anyway, it's a hell of a thing. I wish somebody would write a book about it that really lays it all out. I wonder, where is Luke? Maybe he's in Tasmania writing a book. Should try to talk to him. You know, I didn't even look at the screen to see if anybody was calling in, so maybe you got sick of listening to me talk and holding the phone to your ear, and so you hung up. Maybe you didn't even call at all. But if you want to call, there's still a good 10 minutes left here. Call in. It's 512-646-6446. 512-646-6446. And so, in long answer to your question, I don't know anything about the Sybelle Edmonds case that didn't come out at the times of those, at the time of those times articles, or at least maybe the last word on it that I know is the interviews that I did with Luke Ryland, Sybelle Edmonds, and then with good old what's-his-name that was one of the reporters who covered. I can picture his face from his Huffington Post picture and everything. I just can't think of the guy's name. I'm sorry. Who helped write the Times piece. Anyway, yeah, there you go. Hey, there's somebody who's calling in, man. Let's talk to them about, you know, whatever, subelements or whatever you like. Hey, I'm Scott.
Hey, Scott. This is Sneaker from the chat room. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, man?
Cool. Hey, pretty good. You know, I don't know if I really have anything interesting to say, but I thought I'd better call, and I never did before, and it's cool to have you back.
Hey, thanks for saying so, man. It's good to have you around. It's good to know that I can, well, basically screw off for a month and a half and come back and still have people who are loyal listeners to the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, sometimes Raimondo isn't enough. You know, you need a little extra. And every day doesn't hurt either, does it? So, but, yeah, I mean, you know, what would we do without you guys, right? We all need to step up and get our asses in gear and, you know, point our intellectual bayonets toward the state, right? I mean, that's it.
Yeah. There's even a bumper sticker like that that some genius came up with that says, "Terrorist Schmarist, the state is my enemy." And that's how I like it, rude and to the point.
That's right. Well, and you know what? The Hippocratic Oath is, you know, first do no harm. I don't know if maybe I heard Lou Rockwell say this once, but my whole trip now is first educate yourself. Before I go getting in people's face and telling them how everything should be and why it's wrong, I need to have that locked down for myself. And so that's it. I don't know. I'm kind of rambling, but I just wanted to call and say hi. So there you go.
That's cool. Well, thanks for calling, man. Practice, practice.
Yep. Later.
Take care. All right, everybody, that was Sneaker from the chat room. Nice to talk to him for the first time. See, I like this taking calls. I'm going to get better at this and practice with the whole flow of the call taking thing. Anti-War Radio, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Z down in Texas.
Hey, wait, I'm sorry, you're down too quiet. Say what now?
This is Z down in Texas.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, pretty good, man. Hey, really like your show. Glad you're back. What, if anything, can you say about the Al-Zaidi, the shoe thrower guy? And how he was held incommunicado, and how they decided to charge him with the, you know, 15-year maximum penalty versus the 3-year maximum penalty. And what, if anything, do you know about all that?
Well, you know, I don't know the exact details. The last I saw, he was going to have to show up in, you know, quote unquote court there, and they were going to decide what to do with him. You know, I wish the guy's the best. Honestly, he's a hero of mine. I thought there was just a beautiful thing that he did. And in fact, I don't know if you saw that somebody threw a shoe at the prime minister, so-called the premier of China, during a speech at Cambridge. And this kind of thing is catching on. People showing throwing shoes at politicians. I think it's great.
I think that's a trend that should continue.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, look, here's what really gets me about this. Because here, you got the whole part of the story is like, you know, this poor guy's been thrown in a dungeon. We know for a fact that he was beaten at least pretty badly. I don't know if any bones were broken or what, but he was severely beaten upon arrest. And nobody really knows. There's, you know, obviously, you know, Banana Republic style court system there. So God knows what kind of pain and suffering he's had to endure just in the few weeks since then. That can be a lifetime in American / Iraqi torture custody. So God knows what's happened to this poor soul. But then here's the thing about it that gets me is the crass attitude of the American people, and particularly the American media. Because here's this guy throws this shoe and says, "Here's your departing kiss, you dog. This is for the dead, and the orphans and the widows of Iraq." That wasn't the exact quote, but very close. And all over the world, that was reported. But in America, it was reported that he said, "This is your goodbye kiss, you dog. It was just, I know that was how I saw it on local news in Austin before I left, was, "This is your goodbye kiss." Like, oh, well, what does that mean? Oh, apparently Arabs don't like shoes, or duh, duh, duh. And it was nothing. And people were joking that, you know, he's way better off than under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein would have just chopped his head right off or something, and this guy's going to get away with it scot-free. Everything's going to be great. When in fact, this guy's had to go through absolute hell so far and may very well die in prison. And in fact, the day that he went off to prison, it had just been in the paper that a 23-something, I think, year-old young man had died in custody, and nobody could really explain why. Gee, I wonder if he was beaten to death in there. You know, this is the jail that this poor guy's being turned over to. It's like the fourth ring of hell. And Americans are going, aha, this is all just a big joke. And they didn't even get to hear the part about this is for the dead, for the widows and the orphans, that this guy was standing up for helpless victims here. He wasn't just saying, I don't like Bush or some stupid crap. And it just bothers me because I know, like, people that I care about even were saying, oh, yeah, well, he'll get a fair trial and everything will be fine. And Saddam Hussein would have really been bad to him, but he's going to be just fine now and all this.
No. Well, is there anything that you know of that we can do to advocate for him in any way whatsoever?
Throw your shoe at a politician.
Yeah. All right. Great show, Scott. I'll let you go.
Hey, man. Thanks for calling.
You got it. Later.
All right, y'all. It's Anti-War Radio on Chaos. I'm having fun. I'm glad you all are calling in. Dare I refresh the page at antiwar.com to see what carnage has taken place since this show started? First of all, there's a bunch of great people endorsing antiwar.com, saying nice things about it. And nope, still just the same coverage of the widespread death and destruction in Afghanistan and Iraq. And portents of further destruction coming for the people of Palestine. Some really great articles. Jonathan Turley, I'm going to try to see if I can get him on the show for early next week. Top Obama aides embrace Bush's war on terror rhetoric and enemy combatant policy. And there is no better defender of American civil liberties than Jonathan Turley. He really is a hero of our Bill of Rights, and I will try to arrange an interview with him for next week. It's a great article. I recommend you go read it. And then, of course, as I referred to earlier, Glenn Greenwald's great coverage of Obama's betrayal of his own sworn promise to repudiate the Bush administration's use of the state secrets privilege to keep incriminating information about government employees out of court. You knew all along that there never could be prosecutions of the war criminals of the Bush administration, no matter what law they broke. But now Obama is sealing forever and making sure that they will not be able to sue either. They won't even be able to sue in England. Because if the English let them get away with presenting evidence in court, America is threatening to cut off all intelligence from the English. You know, like these are the bad old days and the MI6 is completely, you know, top to bottom infiltrated with Soviet spies or something. We're going to cut the British, our best allies in the whole world. Not that I think America should have alliances. I'm just going by their standard, you know. Our best friends in the whole world, the British, threatening to cut off their access to American intelligence that perhaps could even warn them of impending attacks in their country if they allow civil lawsuits to proceed on their shores. What a despicable, disgusting disgrace of a government this is. I hope all those of you who cried on election night, tears of joy, that finally everything was different, can figure out a way to get around your illusions and delusions. You really think they would have let somebody who wasn't a lying, murdering, imperialist, militarist, SOB, be the president of America? Do you think he would have got anywhere near the ability to beat out Hillary Clinton in the primaries without the entire Democratic Party establishment, i.e. Satan, behind him? Come on now. Everything changed. You guys are breaking my heart, man. Everything changed. Everything changed on September 11th, too. Remember that? Except everything didn't really change, it just got worse. It was all the same thing as before, only more violent and more expensive. Anyway, that's just me. Apparently. Well, and you guys. Alright, so that's it. That's been Anti-War Radio. Thanks everybody for tuning in. It's Chaos in Austin, Texas. See y'all later.
got a feeling.